I don't know if there's a more false story other than, oh, it's all about work-life balance. There mm-hmm. is no balance. It's one is going to get more of your time than the other at all times of your life.
Yeah.
And this is it. This is the time in my life where I can give more time to work.
Welcome to the Pressure Tested Podcast. Rinda, we're so excited to have you here with us today.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
I have been wanting you to come on ever since Kate went to work for Truist. She's told me so much about you. She just looks up to you so much. I'm so excited for you to be here. I want to really just dive right in and immediately start talking about your career progression. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us about it.
Yeah. So funny story. You know, I wasn't ever meant to be a banker necessarily. I went to school to be an English teacher, really wanted to teach elementary school, maybe junior high, and worked as a teller part-time at Bank of America way back in the day. And as I was working there, the branch manager really just said, Rinda, you have a special connection with clients. And they really trust you and they want to listen to you. So why don't you go and work in new accounts for a while and see how that goes part-time? And I said, okay, I did that. And then as I naturally progressed, I just decided to switch career paths entirely, stayed in banking, went into investments, branch management, commercial banking, and here I am today.
That's crazy.
Wild road.
Yeah, that. So your degree is in English?
Uh-huh. Really? That's right.
I do not have a finance degree. I have a business degree. So yeah. As soon as people start talking about all the super high-end finance stuff, I'm just like, oh my gosh, I should have a degree in this because there's a lot to it.
Yeah, and you learn on the fly so much, right? People take time with you and really teach you how to dig into the numbers. And I think a lot of people really were instrumental in that for me.
It's actually funny because me and Garrett will giggle about this, is we never understand what anybody's titles mean.
Right.
So it's like everyone's a VP, and I don't know if they're in charge of like half the bank or if they're in charge of, you know. So I know that your title is Dallas Market President. So can you break down this like barrier for us? Like what are these banking titles?
Yeah, it's interesting. And at every bank, it's a little different, right? I, you know, funny story, when I first became a vice president at JP Morgan, mm-hmm. my dad told everyone I was the vice president of JP Morgan. And I was like, no, dad, I'm not the vice president. I am a. As Dallas Market President for Truist, and it's different at every bank.
Okay.
But for me, it's basically three things that I'm accountable for. Okay. And that's one, being in the community and present and visible, helping with the brand. Two is leading a team of commercial bankers, Kate being one of them. Okay. I'm really excited to have her on the team. And three, bringing business into the bank. I mean, it's business development. So those are the three things that kind of wrap in to my title, and I lead the market for that.
That's amazing. So that leads me right into kind of the next thing I want to talk to you about. I am always so in shock of your LinkedIn and how many you're like my LinkedIn hero. But you know, I have all of these desires to find, you know, board seats and nonprofits that I care about and I want to help, and you know, it just seems like it's really overwhelming to me. And so you have more board seats than anyone I know. So mm-hmm. tell me about this. Like, how did you find these organizations?
Yeah, so I really have a heart for children, women, education. Like those three things are so important to me. And I'm fortunate that I work for a company that really supports my desires to give back to the community. You know, the purpose statement of Truist is to inspire and build better lives in communities. And that's what I feel like I'm doing with my board work. It is a fine balance. This is the season of life in which I can give back as much as I do.
Yeah.
I think if my kids were young, which mm-hmm. now they're all in their 20s and everyone's out of the house,
nice.
It's a different time in my life, you know, and I can do that. And I'm so thankful that boards have asked me to join them. And it's my honor to give back really to these organizations, Parkland Health being one that's really important to my heart. You know, my mom was a nurse and worked at Parkland.
Oh, cool.
She retired from Parkland. So that one was just such an honor. But all of them.
Parkland's the community, like,
absolutely.
So it's kind of the JP. I'm more familiar with Fort Worth, but like it's kind of the JPS of Dallas.
Absolutely. I mean, without Parkland, you know, a lot of our vulnerable citizens wouldn't have great health care, and Parkland provides that.
Man, that's amazing. What other boards are you on?
United to Learn.
Okay. I met the CEO of United to Learn at an event that you and Kate were at,
That's right.
She was great.
Abby Williams, amazing woman. She founded it, and
that's cool.
It's doing remarkable work in many of the DISD public schools. Nexus Health, I'm sorry, Nexus Family Recovery Center.
Okay, so that's a drug rehabilitation center.
That's right, use disorder. So it's one of the only ones in North Texas. In fact, I think it's the only one in North Texas, let me clarify.
Okay.
That allows women with children or women who are right. pregnant to enter into their care.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. That's
pretty
so cool.
Incredible.
That's yep. so cool. So what does it mean for all of the other people out there that are, you know, kind of at this stage in their career and they're thinking, okay, now it's time for me to give back to the community? What's kind of the first step of doing that?
I think one, it's finding out or really being clear with what's important to you as an individual, right?
That's such good advice.
And then looking into each of the organizations and seeing where it lines up with your values and how you can help. I mean, Texas Women's Foundation is another one. It's natural for me. I have four daughters. This women's issues are really
That's
important.
A woman CEO too, right?
Yep. Who? Karen Hughes.
I've met her too. She's really great.
She is amazing. And she's, I think, been on board as CEO for just over a year and has implemented a lot of changes. And she's incredible.
That's
great
so
leadership
cool.
and a great board.
I definitely relate to that because I have been, you know, really down this path for about a year of thinking, how am I going to get involved with my community? How am I going to get back? And, you know, when I have had opportunities to join boards, it wasn't something that just really spoke to my heart. Mm-hmm. Like I just didn't, and it's like I'm going to have to find the one that really speaks to my heart because it is a time commitment. You have to be passionate about it.
Yes.
And, you know, I really like puppies. Like, I'm going to have to go find, you know, befriend somebody at, like, Operation Kindness or something.
Yeah.
I've got to go that route to at least get started so I can learn more about it. But
volunteer. You know, that's a great place to start to figure out where you want to work.
That's a great
where you
idea.
Want to be a board member.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Something that I always think is fun for bankers, and I always kind of wish I was a fly in the wall of the people that work in banks, but I think that you have such a interesting vantage point on kind of the inner workings of other businesses, and you get to, you know, you get to see the financials, you get to kind of have these covenants in place that keep the business in line.
Sure.
And so you really have access to see some of the decisions that get made behind them succeeding and failing. And we have, or at least I hope we have, a lot of entrepreneurs that listen to this show that know absolutely nothing about accounting, banking, any of that. What advice do you give those entrepreneurs?
Yeah, it's a great question. So my dad was an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. My husband, Russell's an entrepreneur. I think in both of them, what I saw and what I noticed really early and what I see and what I want to see for my clients and prospects is definitely knowing your numbers. And if that's a weakness of yours, finding someone that you really trust or trying to learn it yourself. So for instance, Russell is a man that wants to dig into every single financial line item there is. Mm-hmm. So he really taught himself and really spent the time to figure out how the business works, which margins work, which don't. And I think as a business owner, instilling those financial disciplines early in the business is what's really important. And communicating with your banker. Your banker wants to hear from you. Good news, bad news, in-between news, we want to know it.
Yeah, that's good advice. We were really blessed to have just such a good bank as a partner that came to us when we were really, quote-unquote, not bankable yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I look back at Moss and I'm like, they're one of the reasons we are where we're at today.
That's fantastic.
Because they figured out how to kind of broker a deal for us that allowed like a capital firm to kind of come in and really kind of factor a retainage, if you will. And it allowed us to get to the capital that we needed to kind of bridge the gap. And I just think it's so cool that banks can, with the right partners, really be instrumental in their success.
Absolutely. I mean, we work with non-bank lenders all the time and partners, right? Because it's not always possible for the bank to come in with a bank product that can help.
Yeah.
But we have partners that we work with and factoring companies and other partners that really do a great job, and the whole mission is to get the client or the business on track to be that traditional bankable client.
Yeah. So if you really, I really always think that banks are kind of the lifeblood of the entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I mean, at some point, the entrepreneur has to go to a bank and be bankable and get your help. So to develop that partnership is super important. So this was a fun question that I kind of put out to you, and your answer to this just really surprised me so much. But the question is, what advice do you give to other women that want to be in your shoes one day?
Yeah. So
tell me about your original thought on this.
Yeah, my first reaction was, why would anyone want to be in these you know, it's the immediate why that, or who am I to really provide this advice, you know? And it's a mindset shift, basically, and realizing that, you know, all of us have wanted to be in someone else's shoes or grow into a certain path, right? Sure. And I am very fortunate that some people look up to me and look to me as being a leader in the industry and want to be in these shoes, which, you know, I laugh about still. But I would say for a lot of people, this is a balancing act, and this is the season of my life. Again, I go back to that. Like, I don't know if there's a more false story other than, oh, it's all about work-life balance. There mm-hmm. is no balance. It's one is going to get more of your time than the other at all times of your life.
Yeah.
And this sure. is it. This is the time in my life where I can give more time to work. So I advise a lot of young women and women with small children and families, you know, like, take it easy. You know, time will be there when it's meant to be for you. And that doesn't mean you don't raise your hand for bigger projects or you don't take on extra responsibility. It means all those things, but it's also knowing what your boundaries are and when it's time for you to push harder and when you can step back a little bit too. It's a balance of those types of things versus work-life balance.
So I think it's really interesting because I think for you, it's so much more humility than it is imposter syndrome. Mm. But I feel like women really go through this where they're like, you know, super successful women like you, to not immediately be like, well, this is the exact advice I'd give to these young people because everybody wants to grow up and be successful like yeah. me. Like, you don't have that at all. And I don't see it. It's just like natural humbleness, which is really great to see. But for the women in the world that do have just this really hard time with imposter syndrome, like, why do women do that? Why do women just not kind of look at themselves as like badass females? Like, why do they struggle with this?
I mean, I think it's an age-old question, right? And, you know, after raising four daughters, I mean, I still struggle with imposter syndrome myself. I struggle watching them go through it at times. I don't know why it's there, other than, you know, the statistics show at a certain age, girls stop raising their hand in math class, or, you know,
what?
Yeah, things like that. I mean, you've seen these, right? Where
I haven't heard that before. That's interesting.
Where they stop asking questions, or they stop raising their hands, or whatever, you know, or, you know, run fast like a girl. You've seen that commercial, right? Like, how fast do you run? How do girls run? And girls are running really fast.
Yeah.
But if a boy is imitating a girl running, it's not as fast, or it's fun, or what have you. I think it's just, some of it's innate, and I hope to break some of these barriers, and I hope my girls break the barriers for their daughters, but it's very normal, and I think everybody has it time to time, and I have it regularly.
What did you, so it's just funny that we got to attend that event together today, and so I'm going to go off script a little bit, but what did you think of that crazy statistic that women aren't going to have equal footing in the workplace until 2075?
Yeah, it was pretty amazing, right? I read that statistic earlier in the week too, because I think it's 22%, I think, and she mentioned it too, Lori Grace mentioned it, 22% of, or it would take 22 years, sorry, for white women.
Yes.
And another 28 years for women of color. And I thought, wow, this is so interesting. And it's crazy because when you think about it, 50 years, right? 50 years from 50 today,
years.
That's a couple of generations.
Yeah.
So that's not my daughters. That's not my daughter. Maybe my daughter's daughters or theirs.
Yeah.
So it's pretty wild. It's an incredible statistic and very sad.
I think it's sad too. It's so wild to me. And I think that, to be perfectly honest, I'm just built a lot differently than most women. But, you know, something that really struck me today in that meeting was her talking about the broken rung.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, whenever I see that, and this is shame on me for thinking this, but I immediately think of my friend who, you know, had been a CPA for the last 15 years, worked all the way up through one of the big four, but was trying to get pregnant. It took her 5 years to get pregnant. And she got pregnant, and I knew it, she knew it, everyone knew it as soon as she got pregnant. the likelihood of her going back to work was highly, it was just unlikely, because it had been so emotional for her to get pregnant.
Sure.
And I can't tell every woman in the world, no, you know, have the baby, come back to work, you know, or
right.
Otherwise we're going to have this broken rung thing, because so many times it happens when, you know, women are like 25 to 35, you know, and it's like, and then they want to get back in the workforce at 40, and it's like, they've already missed that promotion.
Yeah.
If you're mentoring a young person, like, what advice do you give them?
You know,
can you give them advice?
I think I can. I think, you know, I worked the entire time I was raising a family. Mm-hmm. But at the time when the kids were at home, it was really important for me to, one, show them what work looks like
yeah.
a hardworking mom, outside, inside, home, whatever it is, like just to see that as an example, right? Mm-hmm. For me, I chose to work outside the home. Secondly, my choice was to be home for dinner every night with my kids. That was important. That's why I didn't want to take those assignments that would maybe have me work after hours or whatever it was. But what I could do is, after I put them to bed, if I needed to work, I could keep working and keep up. And that was the choice I made. So I think it's really important for young women and moms who are working outside of the home to understand there is a balance.
Yeah.
And your partner at home is a really important factor in that. Your partner has to support those decisions as well. And maybe you take turns and you ebb and flow. But I know for a lot of young people, especially young couples, both partners are trying to climb the ladder, right?
Yep.
They need to take turns. And I think that's really important to have that understanding.
I need you to say that a little bit louder for all the men that are listening. No, I think that that's something I run into. I'm so lucky to have just like this husband who, you know, if I'm like, hey, I've got a meeting at 8:30. That means he might take two kids in two different directions, but he's there for me and he's going to do it, and he never thinks twice about it. Because in his brain, there's never a thought that he's not part of the team.
Right.
But I manage women. I mentor women. I just am friends with women who are married, and they do not have that at all. Like, they're waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning to make four lunches before they go to work. And like, how do you impress upon them, like, go home and have a serious conversation with your husband about helping?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you, you know, it's like, I feel like there's always such a fine line between what you can really give advice on and what you can't.
You know, I think when I'm talking to my children, my girls especially, and one of the questions that you and I talked about was, you know, what's the most important factor in your success in your career?
Yeah.
And I think, after thinking about it a lot, I think it really is the person you're married to or the person that you're in partnership with. Mm. Every single day, because that person has to understand what's important to you in your career as far as that path, and what's important to you as a family, and mm-hmm. what's important to them as a family and as in their career. So your choice of partner, I think, is like instrumental in your career. I don't think there's any split between the two. I really think it's fundamentally, at its core, one of the most important choices you can make.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It took me a long time to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't something that just naturally, like, I just kind of assumed that people could just grind their way to the top a little bit, regardless of anybody else helping. But all of the most successful people I know have really great support at home.
Absolutely. I would not be in the position I am today without my husband.
So tell me about your four daughters.
Yeah.
So what are they doing?
So they range in ages from 27 to 23, and we're a blended family.
Okay.
So my 27-year-old works in marketing. She's a paid media special manager. Yeah, I need to get that right. The next one, she would kill me. The next eldest is Olivia, and she's in Berlin, and she works in cybersecurity.
Wow,
as a Russian threat analyst. Yeah,
what?
Pretty wild job. I know.
That's cool.
She must be really busy right now, right? You can imagine. Ava is my youngest. She's in Louisville, Kentucky, and she nannies for a wonderful family.
Oh, cool.
And then Audrey is the youngest, and she's applying to grad school right now.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. So four girls.
Four girls.
Okay. I'm going to be calling you in a few years, because my daughters are just now getting to that age where like, so-and-so is cute at school.
Oh, yeah.
And me and my husband are like, what? Oh, no.
Whoa. Oh, yeah.
And so my oldest daughter, she's 13, and she's just obsessed with this boy at school. She's like, oh, I saw Sawyer in the hallway today. I don't even know what to tell her. I'm so far removed from, like, the dating world. And she was like, she texted him the other day, and he's like, you know, boys, like, they're the driest people on the planet. And, you know, he's just like, hi. And, like, he doesn't text. I don't know. girls are going to be tough. Oh, like, I almost wish I would have had boys, because boys are just easy, you know? You just kind of throw them out there and
figure it out. I know, but then girls are so sweet when they're sweet, you know?
Yeah, they are.
I mean, you know, I spend a lot of time with them, and now that they're adults, it's wonderful spending time with them. Like, I feel like I have this little, you know, group of women that I can go to mentor me, and I can mentor as well. Like, I don't think it's one way or the other. I learn from them equally, you know, so it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I agree with that. I feel like I'm, you know, because when you have a career and you have kids, you either spend time with the people you work with or you spend time with your kids.
Sure.
And so it's like my daughter, sometimes I feel like they're my best friends a little bit. Like, if I'm reading a book, I'm like, oh, let me tell you about my book. And they'll remember me telling them about it. It's, so, yeah, I definitely understand that. Yeah. So let's go back to something you just said. So one of my questions was, you know, what's the one thing you think you've done that's really kind of set the trajectory for your whole career? And you said about kind of the partner that you chose. I think that's great. But what else would you add to that?
Oh, that's a great question. In addition to the partnership, I think, which is fundamental, I think it's really choosing a company that's aligned with your values and making sure that whatever their core values are, or what they want to do, aligns with what you want to do in your life, and make sure it matches up. If you're working for a company where it doesn't align with you, you're always going to be out of alignment, right?
Yeah. And
definitely. Therefore, your work is going to be harder. You're going to be thinking about willpower to stick through it for the day or what have you, right? If it's not in congruence, I guess. When it is aligned with you, and when you find that you can find a lot of things that are mutually agreed upon, it makes it a lot easier, and productivity is much better too. That's for me and for anyone that works for a company, right? If you're aligned, it's gonna go really well. If you're not aligned, it's going to be really difficult. So I would say your second thing is really choosing a company that makes sense to you. And I know here at Moss, you guys have your core values.
Oh yeah.
And I think that's really important to have.
Yeah, that was super important for us. Right before we did our core values, we had just this really smart guy said to us one time, we were talking about burnout and, you know, how do you prevent burnout? And he said something really smart. He said that people don't, people have an infinite ability to work, and people burn out when they stop believing in the mission.
Right.
And I was like, after I heard that, that really changed the way I thought about work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even to this day, because everybody gets burned out, like Friday afternoons, I'm burned out and ready to go home, ready to decompress for the week. And, you know, but I never stopped believing in the mission, which I think is why I have the energy to kind of come back Monday. But like earlier in your career, especially when your kids were young, did you ever go through a job where you would just feel so burnt out every day afterwards?
You know, I'm really fortunate that I've worked for some really amazing people. Most of the time, I would say that after I had children, I think everybody knew how important it was for me to be at home at a certain hour, or, you know, not working extra nights or extra weekends or anything like that. I think having those really open conversations early, even when you're interviewing, to making sure that, you know, they line up with what you think you need. And I know the job market is different today than it was 30 years ago, and choices aren't as vast as they were maybe when I was, you know, coming up. But I really had open, candid conversations with every person I worked for and said, hey, you know, I'm a single mom. This is the situation. This is what I need. And I was fortunate. I worked for some really amazing people.
So you went through some of it being single.
And, oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
For sure.
That's tough. Something you said is interesting to me. I think that a lot of times when people interview for jobs, they just allow people to interview them. Versus tell people what they want out of a job. And I can just think back to somebody that I recently hired that I kind of go back to the interview and I'm like, you know, I wish that they would have been more upfront with some of the things that were going on in their lives to just kind of set in place expectations, right? So what advice do you have for women to just kind of, when they're interviewing a company, what would you have them ask or do?
It's a great question. You know, I think using Kate as an example, as she started newly on our team, right? I said, as much as you're asking me questions and getting to know the bank, I mean, I want her to ask questions, right? Like, I want her to challenge her notions of what the bank can deliver to and let the bank prove up how we can provide solutions and capabilities. Like, it's not a one-way street. This is a two-way street. We have to perform for her. Mm-hmm. She has to perform for us. And it's mutual.
Yep.
Right? But I think it's okay to ask questions and poke here and there to find the right avenues to get things done. But not only that, to challenge the status quo. Yeah. And I have no doubt that Kate will be a game changer for us.
Yeah. But, yeah. I love Kate. She's funny. Let's talk a little bit about, so I just recently started following you on social media. Uh-huh. And you know, I'm not stalking you, I promise. But in that time, I think you've been to Australia, maybe you've been to Europe.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about traveling and kind of how that makes you perceive kind of this little DFW bubble we live in.
Yeah. Well, I was born in Dallas, so this is my hometown. Yeah. And I would say I definitely feel like I won the lottery being born in the United States, mm-hmm. And especially in Dallas.
Yeah, absolutely.
But traveling does give you a perspective that's incredible, right? This year, I had started off the year with a bang, I think. I went to Sydney, Australia, which is my husband's hometown.
Oh, cool.
So we try to go every year.
Oh, that's neat.
And January is my birthday month, so it's a fun time to go. It's summertime. It's really beautiful. So we were there for a couple of weeks. And then we got back and went to Cuba. And that might have been where you thought I was in Europe. But Cuba was a really interesting trip. So I'm a part of the Dallas Assembly.
Okay.
So it was an educational trip.
Okay.
So they do an international seminar every year. And this one was in Cuba. And I think what I learned about my experience in Cuba is, one, we are very, very fortunate to live in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
Two, the human spirit is unbreakable, it seems. I mean, the Cuban people are just incredible work ethic, trying to work around what they can. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, doctors are making $15, $20 a month, you know, and they work side hustles like at restaurants.
Because it's communism, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, there are sanctions and all those things on Cuba. And, you know, this is not a political discussion by any means, but it was interesting perspective. And you come back home and you realize that you are indeed very, very fortunate if you doubted it for a second, which I try not to. But it was an incredible learning experience. And if you get the chance to go, I would go.
It's funny. You know, I read I read some historical fiction book, and it kind of got me interested in Cuba a few years ago. But I thought that it was still is it safe? Did you feel safe?
Well, yes.
Okay.
So we went as a group, like I said, educationally. Yeah. So we were approved to go, because right now you have to be approved to go.
Okay.
And so we did feel very safe.
Okay.
I didn't feel like in trouble or in danger at any point during the trip. It was a really well-organized trip, too. So the folks that put it together did a great job, but it seemed very safe to me.
That's cool. Yeah, I've had that experience. I got to travel to my dad. Lived in Thailand when I was younger.
Oh, wow.
And so I went to Thailand a couple times as a teenager. And I remember, even from my very limited perspective on the world, coming back home to the United States and just feeling so blessed to be able to go to McDonald's.
Sure.
But I also agree with what you just said about the human spirit. I mean, talk about encountering some of the happiest people I've ever encountered in my entire life that were very, very much below any poverty level that you and I would even consider.
Yeah, for sure.
And just living the best life, super happy.
Yeah.
So you're right about the human spirit thing. I think that's really cool. It's cool to get to go and travel and see things like that too.
For sure, for sure.
How important was it for you to get your kids out to see stuff like that when they were young?
Yeah, I think, you know, my parents instilled it in us very, very young. My family's from India. As little children, my parents took us every summer that we could afford and go to India.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we saw the reality of India versus the U.S. at that time, and still today, I'm sure. So it was really important for me, for my kids, when they were very young, to take them and show them this is where we're from, this is our ancestry, for them to see it and for them to honor the experience that they have at home.
Man, that's amazing. I've never been to India. That's on the list of things that I would like to see.
It's an incredible country.
Okay, another really cool thing about being in the banking world, and I really kind of lean on Kate for this a lot of times, but I feel like you guys always have access to just like really great economic reports, and you always really seem to have a good pulse on what's next for the area, you know, what's next for DFW. So if you could look into Magic 8-Ball and say, this is what's going to happen in DFW over the next 10 years, what do you think it looks like?
Yeah, a few things. Like, I think Dallas is definitely becoming like its own financial hub, you know, with the creation of the Texas Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
Y'all Street. Mm-hmm. So the which I think Street. Is a great name, by the way.
That.
Great branding. I think so. The growing financial hub part of it is a big deal. Secondly, the number of companies that are coming into the market and expansion. So it's a great opportunity for lenders, both in the commercial and middle market space and in corporate finance, to really work with a lot of these companies as they expand and grow. I mean, North Texas is just, it's an anomaly to me.
Yeah.
And to much of the country, I'm sure. You know, we're adapting and adjusting to this economy too, as bankers, you know, as the rate environment is volatile.
Yeah.
But we have some really great partners that we work with at the bank, you know, in our financial risk management team that we talk about hedging risk all the time.
Yeah.
Interest rate risk. So I think, you know, those three things are really where I think are changing in North Texas, but all over the U.S., but especially in North Texas, the growth, the adaptability of our people, and then expansion of businesses is just tremendous.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, definitely fueled by a lot of people moving to the area.
Oh, for sure.
And, you know, favorable tax area.
For sure.
So, again, not a political conversation, but what are your thoughts on the tariffs that are happening and kind of the future of those?
I think I'm worried for a lot of our nonprofits in terms of that type of stuff. But tariffs affecting our clients, too. I mean, you know, we have a lot of clients that import from China and Mexico and, you know, their profit margins are going to get squeezed, and I don't know what that's going to entail.
Yeah, we're starting to, we haven't seen it on the utility side, but we are starting to get just letters from our heating and cooling suppliers that, you know, import from these countries just saying, hey, it hasn't happened yet, but expect, you know, 3%, 6%, these huge increases, all of which we have to pass on to our customer.
For
I mean, that's the only way you can do it.
For sure.
But the, you know, the whole idea is, does it, in the short term, really produce this idea to stimulate America to start manufacturing here? And it, I mean, can it even really do that quickly? Like, do you have to go through a period of true suffering, you know, for at least the common family or the nonprofit or even the business getting squeezed on profit before it can, you know, really stimulate the economy the way that it's supposed to? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, it's interesting because some of our companies will do better because of it, right?
Okay.
More people will turn to American-made products or locally sourced materials, and some of them will benefit from that. And I think that's a wonderful thing, but at what cost or at what expense to our, you know, other suppliers outside of the country? I really don't know. I mean,
it's hard to say, right?
It's hard to say. Yeah, I don't know if it's an overcorrection to eventually get back in the middle somewhere.
Yeah,
I hope there's a normal path ahead. We'll see.
Well, Rinda, thanks so much for coming on the Pressure Tested podcast. We are so excited to have you today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.